Resonance Rewind. And every so often, some delightful guests from the cosmos. Ooh.
I wish I wasn't afraid all the time, but I am.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Those caught in violation of curfew will be prosecuted without leniency or exception.
It's past curfew, you know.
Gentlemen, I want this terrorist found, and I want him to understand what terror really means.
We're working on several leads.
Her parents were detained when she was 12.
It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth.
You have one chance. You must tell us the whereabouts of Codename V.
If our own government was responsible for the deaths of 100,000 people, do you really want to know?
Those who are responsible will be held accountable.
The time has come for you to live without fear.
I'm ready.
This country stands on the edge of oblivion.
I want everyone to remember why they need us.
Kill him.
I suddenly had this feeling that everything was connected. We're all part of it. Are we ready for it?
The only verdict is vengeance.
Well, we just came out of the an excerpt from the 1812 overture there. And that leads us neatly round to just one of many quotes that we'll be addressing today, which I think is just one of the aspects for this particular edition of Resonance Rewind. Of course, the classic line that artists use lies to tell the truth while politicians use them to cover the truth up. Now, there are so many things that actually will be discussed in this that it's a delight to be able to welcome to Resonance Rewind a newbie making her debut on the production. She's an author, creator of magical words, and I have to say that having now read her latest novel, A Man in Winter, in full, fantastic is the final phrase that I actually use for that. Really good piece there. Katie Marie, welcome to your first ever Resonance Rewind.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you very much for your kind words about my book. I'm really pleased you enjoyed it.
Well, we'll move on to that for another feature. Also from New York, of course, back with us, and rightly so, of course, it's Pamela Sue Mann, ace musician. How are you, Pamela?
I'm great. Thank you.
Excellent.
Good to see you all.
And keeping the American theme going for this particular aspect, in which obviously the United States is not given a positive vibe from that perspective, at least. Maybe that's Alan Moore's thoughts. Jessica Burtis from North Carolina. How are you, Jessica?
I'm doing pretty well.
Excellent. Let's come to you first, Jessica, because we've got so many references here. It goes back to the gunpowder plot. We start off with that whole sequence. We've got the Count of Monte Cristo. We've got the whole notion of the Reformation as in reclamation. We've got a movie which actually I thought was dangerously close to actually coming true during the pandemic in terms of the way that the citizenry are kept locked indoors and prevented from working through that. First time, I presume, we've actually seen the movie version of V for Vendetta, directed, of course, by James McTeague. What are your thoughts?
So I actually have watched this movie once before, but this movie is still, like, it's such a, like, different experience to me than most movies. And I feel like it's just it's such an iconic one. It's like, I'll see the mask quite a lot around. And I think the movie is just, I don't know. I never know how I feel about it. Because it is just so, unique. But yeah, watching it again, knowing kind of the whole plot was more interesting because then you kind of knew, whereas the first time everything was a surprise. And I still remember my shock the first time watching it while like the, you know, Big Ben was exploding in front of a crowd of masked people. But yeah, I think it's still interesting. I think every time I watch it, I would end up seeing more. And this is only the second time I've seen it. So I can't imagine what somebody who's watched it several more times just starts to discover with every rewatch.
Verily, this vichyssoise of verbiage veers most verbose. So let me simply add that it's my very good honor to meet you. And you may call me V. Let's talk about verbiage and let's go back to Katie. Katie, you said when I suggested you join us on A Resonance Rewind that you were a big fan of V for Vendetta. Now, that presumably means you've had multiple viewings of this. Clearly, you also like, as a writer, the original Alan Moore incarnation in which, curiously, the Houses of Parliament are blown up first as opposed to the Old Bailey. But there are a few other minor changes, including, of course, the character of Adam Sutler, who's there. But what are your thoughts on this one, having rewatched it for Resonance Rewind?
Yes, also, well done on getting that tongue twister. I was going to practice that myself, and I thought, no, that's far too much. That's well beyond me. But yes. So this film came out, I think, in the early 2000s. It was 2005. I remember I just started uni when I first saw it. And I remember it really, really sticking with me. And I hadn't actually read the comic book first. I watched the film first. And I remember really, really liking V. He's so charming and sort of dashing throughout the whole film. And then I read the comic. And he's still a good character, but he's so less dashing. I remember Alan Moore, he wasn't a huge fan of the film incarnation of the story because he felt that it had been defanged. And I can kind of see where he's coming from. There's the film is very, very different to the comic in tone, whereas the film is very much a story of good versus evil. The comic's much more nuanced. You get to see people for the fact that they are people as opposed to like caricatures of themselves. But then it was a three volume comic. It was a three books, and they squeezed it into like a 2.5 hour film.
I
But
mean,
yeah, so
certainly.
it's a lot more simplified.
Yeah, I mean, I still feel that James McTeague incorporated an awful lot of material. I mean, you've got the
Oh, he
image of the
certainly
Lady
did.
of Shalott, the Arthurian lady who's part of the underground collection of artistry that V has collected, and the whole message of that. You've got the usage of mirrors, the constant connection of mirrors, and the way in which we look at things. We've got the way in which the population are controlled. And indeed, that whole balance between a democracy, a dictatorship, the challenges of that whole sequence, and of course the secrecy and the hidden nature of
Sorry.
lives and various other bits and pieces that are coming through.
Yeah, you
Pamela,
did. Very good
from
job.
your own side of things, was this your first time you've encountered V for Vendetta?
It absolutely was. And I just want to launch right into something before I forget it. And that is a quote from Alan Moore, which, as all this was happening in the modern age, which we can do very many multitasks if we have several devices handy, I proceeded to order a used copy for my daughter and for myself of the actual, I guess, the book. I don't know if that's the comic that you're speaking of. I've only ordered one book, so I'm really hoping that it was the original book. I don't know. But I'm going to quote Alan Moore: "All government authority is corrupt because it infringes on human freedom." And I have to admit, when I first started watching it, I was like, oh, I don't know. Natalie Portman's accent was like, oh God, what am I? But I stuck with it, and I ended up liking it. I really ended up liking it because of knowing more about what it's about, and also was so bizarre. I don't know if this happened to you all, but when I was watching it, COVID kept coming into my mind. I don't know if that struck a chord with any of you good people, but it at least three times came into my head. COVID. That's all I'm saying.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. It's that battle that we actually see being addressed throughout the whole thing, and also the cover-ups and the way in which, again, echoing the notion of the Count of Monte Cristo, we have this dialogue of vengeance, the way in which the change. We never obviously see V without his mask. The closest we actually get to the occupier of room V or room five is, of course, where he's cooking breakfast, with a wonderful frilly pinny on, and effectively he apologizes to Evie, who emerges with, of course, the magical sounds of Cry Me a River going in the background there. And that whole notion of again how V is portrayed, and his views about Adam Sutler, clearly a reference to Adolf Hitler, Adam Sutler, the connection from that line of things there. I mean, again, just returning to yourself, Jessica, for whom even the character EV is actually based on the Reformation's Eliza Vaux, Vaux, who was known for actually hiding many priests who were being persecuted in the advent of the Reformation in Elizabethan times. So you have that echoes of Elizabethan narrative coming through as well. How did you feel it played out for yourself? I mean, did, as Pamela said, is it something that relates to the COVID scenario? Because I certainly would echo with Pamela. Yeah, I mean, viewed now, 20 or so years after, or nearly 20 years after its original release, where clearly the narrative there was weapons of mass destruction, 9/11, war on terror. The original novel, of course, written very much in the advent of the post-Thatcherite Britain, the challenges with respect to that, and the difficulty projecting ahead, because the original comic book is set in 1997, to the dystopian future we are sleepwalking into. It almost seems as though, sadly, we seem to be reiterating this at various levels as we progress through time. Jessica.
I think I first actually watched this during COVID. So I think the whole themes around the government and politics is very interesting because I do feel like during COVID there was so much going on with politics and kind of a disruption and a lot of riots and unrest. And I think a lot of people were getting very sick of how governments were acting during that time. Especially, I remember like the way that a lot of governments were kind of like refusing to do anything and kind of help people and kind of causing quite a lot of harm. So I feel like in the end, I kind of think that it kind of those kinds of discussions around government have been happening for quite a long time. I think dystopian literature was like such a large facet of like young adult literature when I was a teenager, and kind of discussions around overthrowing the government and revolution were so like at the forefront, I feel like, of a lot of books. And you couldn't really find like books or movies that didn't involve some discussion around like rebellion. But I think that in this movie, it's very interesting that it's all done through one kind of figurehead of, and kind of seeing how his character is somebody who's very morally gray, and that he's kind of willing to do whatever it takes to accomplish his goals, and how he sees to be morally right. I think that's really interesting in how his like treatment of Evie is throughout the movie. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting to kind of read somebody's like, if somebody wrote like a paper about it, about a post-COVID discussion around this.
I mean, there have been many academic papers that have been produced about this, including the notion that you have the two representatives very much at the heart of the narrative, the police officer Finch, who in the end does nothing to stop the blowing up of the Houses of Parliament, because he always has been on a discovery in terms of the lies and the mendacity that's been fed to him. And of course, Evie, who arguably the initial Evie we're introduced to, the person who's scared of the Fingerman and has challenges with respect to that, is indeed rescued by V. Had she not effectively been put through the experience of rebirth through V and again the imprisonment, etc., would she have actually had the courage to effectively press the lever as opposed to lever? But admittedly, that was a nod to the direction, the pronunciation of lever, lever, etc., and send the train, you know, across the underground to obviously blow up the Houses of Parliament. I mean, Katie, you're a mistress, effectively, of the great storyline, the narrative, the area with respect to that side of things there. How did you feel the characters were developed within the novel, from Stephen Fry's game show host, who actually has the show of the century, including Yakety Sacks, the classic Benny Hill moment, which obviously leads to his own demise and his own secrets that he's actually hiding from that point of view, right the way through to obviously the equivalent, I suppose, of in The Count of Monte Cristo, the three main characters there who are kind of effectively executed by the righteous vengeance of our character, in this case, V.
I thought the characters in the film were done really superbly, actually. I thought that they did Evie remarkably well. They got her character arc in there perfectly. Though you say, she starts off as someone who's very put together, but she's terrified all the time. She admits herself in the film that she's scared all the time. And it's, I can't quite think how to put it, but they said that it's because she's happy, for want of a better word. And it's that fear of losing that happiness. And when she is imprisoned and goes through hell, quite frankly, and then she loses that happiness, but then she loses her fear. And she comes out, as you say, she goes through a rebirth, quite similar to how V goes through a rebirth, although it is made visually distinct by the fact that hers is done in the rain, whereas his was done in fire. But I also, I love, and it's going to sound so weird to say that, I love the fact that they kept the unpleasant scenes with Evie being imprisoned in the story, because it did V's character a lot of favours as well, because it shows how he acts. Sorry, I'm trying to find a really good way of putting it, and I'm failing absolutely miserably. Yeah. But it shows how we're forced to reckon with the extreme cost of political violence, because Evie's been very humanized to us. Whereas, again, I'm going to keep referring to her, I'm sorry. But in the comic book, we actually get some nuance and development of some of the Norse Fire party members, whereas you don't get that quite so much in the film, because, again, I'm well aware of time constraints and whatnot. But because they've been humanized, V's actions, you are forced to look at the nuance at the very severe cost we have to pay to reach the end goal. But when you keep the scenes in with Evie and her imprisonment, you still get that that point, so they didn't have to do it twice. So I think that's probably why that was cut from the film. Sorry, I went off on a bit of a tangent.
No, I think it worked. It addressed a number of aspects there. When Evie asks V, "Who are you?" in the early sequence, the response, "Who is but the form following the function of what, and what I am is a man in a mask." Pamela, I'm not sure whether you've ever seen the 1934 Count of Monte Cristo. It is worth watching. It is a classic that stands on his own with on its own with Robert Donat, obviously in the lead role there. And there are an awful lot of echoes between the 1934 Hollywood version of Alexandre Dumas' take on the state and the individual, and where we see this particular narrative going. Any other sort of aspects from your own perspective before we start talking more about favorite characters, how you felt the whole thing was developed as a writer, creator of music yourself?
Thank you. Well, I love the fact that they had Corcovado, Gilberto, which is one of my favorite all-time songs. It's, in fact, that album is my apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic album that I keep on repeat. And anytime the world seems to be absolutely crazy, I just play it on repeat and I never get tired of it. And I very much suggest for everyone to do that. I came up with an idea for Resonance Rewind, which is basically that I think that we should also note our favorite moment. I think we should note our favorite moment in a film, because I think if or our least unfavorite moment, because I think that's interesting. Isn't there usually one little moment in a film? For me, it was the moment of Corcovado, I have to say, but no, as far as the film goes, I thought it developed well and it kept your interest. At first, it didn't really have my interest, and then it grabbed my interest. And then, of course, as I was multitasking and finding more about what the film was about as I was watching it by doing research, I thought this is a very important film, and it had a lot of mixed reviews, some really great reviews, but then also some complete pans as well. But more because of how it portrayed, I'm talking about the film, not the book, because I don't know the book at all. How it portrayed what they were trying to say, what they were, the message that they were trying to give. But I really did like the film a lot. And I was able to watch all but, I think, the last minute or two. So as soon as we're done here, I'm going to go back and I'm going to finish watching that.
Come on and cry me me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
Sounds good. Katie, let's turn to yourself then. In terms of, again, this new feature, as Pamela suggested, a favourite moment in the film. I mean, for me, initially, I thought the incarnation of the bishop with Evie, obviously, in the schoolgirl uniform and the acceptance that actually, oh, it's okay, it's the bishop, just paedophilic, that's fine. And it's not until I actually listen to the notion that actually he's been killed that suddenly the ever-present listeners and the people, and again, that's constant surveillance. You know, we have a society here which is being under constant surveillance. Everything that we do now is being listened to, is being heard, is being acknowledged and checked against the sense of order. But did you have a favorite moment for yourself?
I have two. I absolutely love V's introduction, where he gets to be the hero and he's rescuing Evie and he introduces himself. He is so verbose in his introduction and it's utterly charming, and it immediately warms you up to him, or at least it did me. The minute he walked on and he was like hyper violent for a few seconds, and then he was so articulate, and I was like, yeah, I'm gonna like you, I know you. And then my second one has to be Evie's rebirth, when she's standing outside and all the rain's coming down and you're getting the juxtaposition of V's rebirth and Evie's rebirth, and you're getting to see how much they mirror each other, but at the same time, just how very different they are in their cause. Like, V is much more, as I just said, quite hyper-violent, whereas Evie, as we know, is willing to pull the lever or lever at the end, but she doesn't take any joy in it. She knows it's something that has to be done, and she does it quietly, whereas is V, in his determination to be as loud as possible to get his idea out, because we all know he's hyper fixated on the idea of ideas and symbols, he's much louder and far more brash than she is in that sense, and I really like that sort of contrast with them.
Indeed, we even have the letter V inscribed in the cut and the scar on Evie's head as well. It's shaped in a sort of V base shape, which obviously again has its connotations in V for Victory, the Churchillian aspect as well. And as you rightly said, Katie, that rebirth, that baptism of fire, baptism of water, both literally and metaphysically, in terms of the way in which both characters are developed, which also again connects with the Count of Monte Cristo, in which you could argue that Evie is the character who learns from the Abbé, who would be the, again, going through that cellular structure and finding in the imprisonment some kind of redemption. And even the one thing that she believes isn't true is that autobiography, of course, of Valerie. Again, a vignette of Valerie, who basically, because of her chosen lifestyle, is dismissed by her parents and has a momentary series of happiness before, again, she's also swept away in this very prejudiced, very othering-based society, which, again, in some ways, we might say we, in certain instances, are very close to today, arguably. Jessica, one moment, two moments?
I think one of the most impactful was her reading Valerie's story, and just hearing, and just kind of reading that story and kind of getting to know Valerie through this, and how she came to love Valerie, even though she'd never met her, because she got to meet her through the writing. I think that was really one of the most like moments from the film that has always stuck with me. But I think also then just like that that ending with, you know, seeing all the masked people and Big Ben just blowing up to the overture, like that's such a moment that I feel like is so like it was just crazy. So I think that's one of the most interesting moments in the film.
And again, showing that nothing is permanent, or that all things must pass and everything is impermanent in its own ways. OK, let's move into characters. Katie, favourite character or characters?
That's got to be V, hasn't it?
And not Finch, played by Stephen Ray, or Adam Sutler by John Hurt?
To be honest, there isn't a bad character in this, and they're all portrayed absolutely wonderfully. I love John Hurt. I loved him in I loved him in this, but I loved him in like Hellboy and whatnot as well. He's such a good actor. He was such a good actor, I should say. But
also
yeah,
intriguing that John Hurt, of course, had the lead in the remake of 1984, as indeed Winston Smith, which again, the other side of the coin, really.
Yes, yeah, but yeah, V is definitely my favourite character in this, just because, again, of all the nuance and depth that's there to him. He's, as I said, obviously very highly educated. He's very articulate, and yet he does horrendous things, and it's really cool. It's not really cool. That sounded terrible. I don't mean that what he did was cool. I just mean that he's a very cool character. He's, like I said, he's very well written. He's very well developed. You can really sympathize with him, even when he's doing things that are utterly horrendous. You still give him like a moral pass, because he, a lot of the rules of society, if you look at various philosophers and whatnot, a lot of the unspoken rules of society have already been broken by the Norse Fire Party. So V then has like almost like a moral pass to commit the acts that he does in order to put things to right again.
And there is that sense that in many ways he's simply doing what Plato does in Plato's cave, and actually showing the illusion of how people are sleepwalking into things. There's a wonderful moment where Evie first returns to the TV studio, and she admonishes the man behind the desk for watching a superheroine on TV, when actually, if he'd been paying attention as a security guard, he would never have let the whole TV station be blown up and blown down. And I think, again, that call for vigilance, which, again, those momentary things, I think, do repay repeated viewings. Pamela, did you have a favourite moment as well as characters?
Oh, goodness. Okay. Yeah, I thought it was kind of cute when he showed her his secret room, when Stephen Fry's character, which was a little silly. It was a little like, oh, okay. But I loved it because it was subversive. And, you know, he let her in as her friend, you know, like, hey, came out to her. I thought that was really kind of cool of the moment, and very prescient and very awesome. So there was that one, and there was the Corcovado moment. And actually, I have to say that I think that Natalie Portman did a really great job when she was suffering, and when she went through all that in being imprisoned, and what she had to do, and how she had to emotionally be really raw. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for her, because it seemed very method. and so that was a moment, you know, when she's finally breaking down, and you know, just like finding her strength, finding her bravery within her. That was a poignant moment. So yeah, that moment. So as you know, when I say what my favorite characters are, they really have nothing to do with anything that's going to make any sense outside of my brain. And for that, I apologize. But I have number one, Stephen Fry. Number two, Stephen Rea, because he's Irish. Woo-hoo! And he's great. He's a great actor. And also Hugo Weaving, of course. And my favorite anti-character was, of course, John Hurt, who was brilliant in everything I've ever seen him do. Just, yeah.
And Jessica?
I think Evie is probably my favorite character. I think she's such a gentle character, which I like seeing in a movie about revolution, because often characters are kind of like combative and like aggressive, but she had a very gentle resistance, and I think that was really nice to see.
We haven't, of course, mentioned Sinead Cusack, if we're talking Irish actors, of course, as Delia Surridge, and again, the nurse who receives, if anything, I suppose, the gift of a quiet, peaceful, non-painful death in the Vengeance, even though she was very much part of this whole abomination of experiments that led to the establishment of the Mary virus, the Saint Mary virus, and the whole situation within that. And again, going back to COVID, you have those connections between, was the virus man-made? Was it developed by governments? How did it get released? Was it true? Was it, and so on and so forth. Okay, we are at the stage where we need to start quantifying the qualitative. So let's turn to you first, Jessica. What is your rating out of 10 going to be for this 2005-2006 incarnation of V for Vendetta, which, of course, starred Hugo Weaving after he'd done his Matrix scenarios. And of course, there is a Matrix connection because we do have the Wachowskis, Lily and Lana, who were producers together with David Lloyd for this. And of course, had been actively involved in the Lord of the Rings trilogy as well. Natalie Portman, of course, had also cut her teeth in terms of the Star Wars universe as well. So lots of interesting lines from that. But what is your score going to be, Jessica?
I'd say an 8. I think it's a very interesting movie. And I think that the ideas in it are still relevant to talk about. And I think that it's so, I don't know, it's just an iconic character. I think I don't agree with people who say that like, there was a romance in it. I think it's kind of Stockholm-y. But like, other than that, I think that it's a movie that you can just watch over and over again and still get something out of.
When I first saw it, I did think there were an awful lot of connections with Phantom of the Opera. As time has gone by, I've kind of negated that and have kind of gone more to the notion, especially having seen The Count of Monte Cristo, that actually does relate more to this in terms of how the narrative develops and kind of echoes. But as with all art, it kind of adds more to that. Katie, your score out of 10.
I'm probably going to give it a 9 out of 10 because it is one of my all-time favourite films. I love the writing. I love the characters in it. I love the setting. The score is fantastic. The only reason it's not a 10 out of 10 is because it does like a teensy, teensy, weensy bit of the nuance that the book did have, which gave it that extra bit of oomph.
And Pamela.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to say 7.9 out of 10. Because. I think, yeah, I'm going to give it a 7.9.
And to be fair, you haven't watched the last 3 minutes. It could all change then. Once you listen to the Rolling Stones singing Street Fighting Man, that could also nudge it into the whole sequence. So,
if it reaches 8, I'll send you a very quick text.
I'll probably go 8.5 for this particular thing. Katie, how can people get hold of A Man in Winter? It is available now. I would certainly urge people to get hold of a copy because it's a fascinating insight with, as I say, no spoilers, but an intriguing twist in which you're really not left. You're unsure at the end in terms of did he achieve some kind of validation? Were things appropriate? Did he actually see this appropriately? Or was it just a byproduct of his Alzheimer's? We don't know. It's over the other. How can people get a hold of your latest novel, A Man in Winter?
You can find it on Amazon, and if you just search A Man in Winter, then it will come up on Amazon for you.
And Pamela, we've got some exciting news for your good self, which we'll be revealing obviously on a subsequent Midweek Drive Live. But would you like to just share with us in terms of your latest single and album, and indeed just a little teaser, shall we say, in terms of what's coming through in the Pamela Sue Mann musical world?
There's so much happening. Yeah, I just signed an international licensing deal, which is kind of like a what is that? But it basically enables the entirety of my catalog to be played on film and television and commercials worldwide, which means a little bit of money, which is wonderful. So there's that. And then Pink Flamingos, my album is coming out this year. So we're releasing another single called My Father's Girl, which I've done with Subtle Paranoia, one of my pet projects. And we're busy in the laboratory cooking up things to share. Thank you for
fantastic
enabling me to say
that. and Jessica, your master's dissertation will be finished as well, I'm sure, in the not too distant future. So all's good. Next week on Resonance Rewind, we'll be exploring the Anglo-American relationship once again, together with Quite Books and Rick Davey, in which we look at Roger Moore and Tony Curtis portraying Lord Brett Sinclair and Danny Wilde in an episode that takes us to the heart of the English countryside and Greensleeves. Until then, of course, we will say, as ever, to Katie Marie, to Pamela Suman, and to Jessica Burtis, keep on resonating.